Hello and welcome back to Whence Came You, a Freemasonic podcast featuring research, papers, and discussions related to Freemasonry. I'm your host, Robert Johnson, a York and Scottish Rite Mason, as well as Knight Templar. So let's see, only one more week left until we are dark for Christmas and New Year's. There will be blog posts and Facebook posts and the like, but no audio for the weeks of the 24th and the 31st. I want to mention, I haven't heard any suggestions for the PDF Masonic book this year, so I will pick one unless someone has a suggestion by the 13th of December, 2012. Speaking of 2012, there's a ton of things people are saying about the end of the world. Some people think the Freemasons are guarding this end of the world secret. So, here it is, everyone. Whether you are a Freemason or not, I am going to tell the biggest secret right now. Are you ready? Are you sitting down? All right, good. The big secret is that the world will not end on the 21st of December. In fact, it's not going to end for millions of years. So relax, get cozy and comfortable, because you have all the rest of your mortal lives to live, learn, and love, right here on good old Terra Firma. Now the first piece for you guys this week is a Masonic paper by Worshipful Brother Julian Rees, which is one paper of a 10-paper collection called Musings from the Middle Chamber, from the website www.freemason-freemasonry.com, entitled Freedom in Trust. Freedom in Trust. Ere man's corruptions made him wretched, he was born most noble, that was born most free. Each of himself was lord, and uncoffined, obey the dictates of his godlike mind. Thomas Otway, 1652-1685. I continue to be fascinated by this contradiction. Before initiation, we are part of the bedrock, not yet removed from the quarry. As a result of initiation, we become an individual, a rough ashlar, and yet initiation makes us part of the lodge, an element of the greater whole. A seeming paradox, this, and one for which I am grateful to Worshipful Kirk McNulty. Let me put this paradox another way. An initiation, although principally for the initiate, is not only for him. We all join in with our hearts so that the brotherhood of the many can contribute to the enlightenment of the one, that second freedom which the initiate is about to experience. So, it's a collective endeavor, yet it's also an individual undertaking. The initiate takes the step freely. Only he can do it. Nobody else can do it for him. And he can do it for nobody but himself. Before we attain to the freedom granted by initiation, we need to be free in ourselves, a sort of two-tier freedom. I suppose many thousands of words have been spent searching for the exact nature of this basic freedom which the ritual requires before initiation, and many interpretations have been put on it. I think of it like this. We talk about trusting the initiate, that he will become a true and faithful brother among us, but in fact, he does not know where he is going or what will happen. It is he who places a greater trust in us. True freedom, then, is in trusting those around you. It is a trust in which the first bond is forged. It is like a leap into the unknown because you trust those who have brought you to this place, no matter what the outcome, good or bad. And as Michael Bagan points out, you have to have insight into what's happening in order to be truly free, not blown about by every passing wind. The ceremony of initiation comes as something new, yet the initiate must have a sense of impending dawn, a spiritual birth, an awakening, a focus for all his aspirations. Now we are going to use the words for the ceremony to initiate this candidate. In another article, I suggested that in learning the words and actions of a ritual, we are merely sharpening the carving tools, imitating the operative craftsmen of old. We are not actually carving the stone. The words and the learning of them are the form of our vocation as Freemasons, not the content. Of course, the carving tool should be bright and sharp, but endless repetition of the words of ritual does not lead us to self-knowledge, enlightenment, spiritual growth, or moral development. So how are we to go about this? What is the secret of meaningful rendition of ritual? The answer lies in the one word, heart. We need to feel what we are doing, or the effect will be blunted. Let me give you an allegory. Some years ago, a friend taught me some of the principles of wood turning. The piece of advice that has stuck most firmly in my mind is just rest on the chisel. Don't put pressure on it. Let the wood do the work. It's certainly true of wood turning, as I found. I think it's probably also true of Masonic work. The relationship between the initiate and the lodge is a very special one. The individual is out on his own, in a sense carried along by the collective, borne forward on the wind of goodwill, harmony, and love. Fanciful? I don't think so. We are living in a wicked world where all kinds of disharmony and evil are seemingly allowed full rein by turning aside for a moment from the jarring sounds of war, injustice, suffering, chaos, disagreement, and discord, and concentrating on real values in ourselves and in our collective pursuit of spiritual advancement. We gain real strength, real inner nourishment. Here is a flight path we can follow, leading us even to the throne of God Himself, where nothing is required of us either as an initiate or a participant in the initiation except goodwill, harmony, and love. As regards your rendition of the ritual, don't worry too much about the effort you put into it, as long as you know the words in essence. Feel the principles of what you're doing, the heart, the light. Let them do the work. Alright, next I have to mention the Apple and Android app which let you listen streaming and have access to the papers we read on the show as well as Masonic mobile wallpapers. Secondly, you can get the Stitcher Smart Radio app. It works the same way except there are no bonus features. Just be sure to support the show by using the promo code WhenceCameU with no spaces so Stitcher Smart Radio makes a $1 contribution to help keep the lights on. Moving on, I heard a poem this week. It was at a Masonic funeral. I heard it and thought, wow, this poem really does embody one of the things we try and do in Freemasonry. So, I want to read it for you now, and while you listen, see if you can guess where I am going with this. An old man going a lone highway came at the evening, cold and gray, to a chasm vast and deep and wide, through which was flowing a sullen tide. The old man crossed in the twilight dim. The sullen stream had no fear for him, but he turned when safe on the other side and built a bridge to span the tide. "Old man," said a fellow pilgrim near, "you're wasting strength building here. Your journey will end with the ending day. You never again will pass this way. You've crossed the chasm deep and wide. Why build you this bridge at the evening tide?" The builder lifted his old gray head. "Good friend, in the path I have come," he said, "there followeth after me today a youth whose feet must pass this way. This chasm that has been naught to me, to that fair-haired youth may a pitfall be. He too must cross in twilight dim. Good friend, I am building this bridge for him." And that was called The Bridge Builder by Will Allen Dromgoole. So now that you've heard it, it's not long or anything, in fact very short and sweet, but I am sure you understand now that Freemasons are always at labor, trying to leave this world better than when they came into it, to relieve the distressed, to make life easier for the new generations. Next is a piece from the Freemasons for Dummies website. I love this post because it has feeling, and it will lead to this week's famous Freemason. And to start this off, I want to tell you that the article is called The Death of George Washington, but George Washington is not the famous Freemason. To enlarge the sphere of social happiness is worthy of the benevolent design of the Masonic institution, and it is most fervently to be wished that the conduct of every member of the fraternity, as well as those publications which discover the principles which actuate them, may lead to convenience mankind. That the grand object of Masonry is to promote the happiness of the human race. I sincerely pray that the great architect of the universe may bless you and receive you hereafter into his immortal temple. George Washington. On Thursday, December 12th, 1799, George Washington rode out to inspect portions of his five farms, as he had nearly every day since the end of his presidency. Unfortunately, on this particular day, he was caught in the rain, wind, and sleet of a terrible winter storm. When he returned that afternoon, his hair caked with snow. He was quite wet in spite of his woolen greatcoat. The next day, he went out into 3 inches of new snow and freezing weather and insisted on marking trees he wanted to cut down. His throat was sore, and he became hoarse as the day progressed. By late evening, it was clear that he was having trouble breathing. On Saturday morning, he had a severe fever and could hardly speak. He asked his personal secretary, Tobias Lear, to send for his family physician, Dr. James Craik, who had served with the general during the French and Indian War, and all through the Revolution. Washington's wife Martha also sent for Dr. Gustavus Brown, who was living across the river from Mount Vernon in Maryland, in case Craik was otherwise detained. Washington anticipated that Dr. Craik would prescribe bleeding to draw off the bad blood that was believed to cause fever and illness, so he had Lear send for Alban Rawlins, one of Washington's overseers from his nearby Union farm, a veterinarian who was also proficient in the practice of bloodletting. The general wanted him to get an early start, even if the doctors hadn't yet arrived. Martha was alarmed over the amount of blood that Rawlins drained from her husband, even though Washington kept encouraging him to draw more, more. Dr. Craik arrived shortly thereafter and concurred that bleeding was the proper treatment, especially since the general couldn't manage to swallow any throat-soothing mixtures that were offered. One attempt to gargle nearly choked him to death. Craik drew more blood, but he had desperately wanted another opinion. Since Dr. Brown had not yet arrived, he sent for Dr. Elisha Cullen Dick, a resident of Alexandria and master of the Alexandria Lodge No. 22, where Washington was a member. Eventually, all three doctors were in attendance and attempted to diagnose Washington's deteriorating condition. Brown and Craik decided it was quinsy, an inflammation related to tonsillitis. Dr. Dick was considerably younger than the other two physicians, and his education was more recent and better informed in new methods of diagnosis. He believed that Washington's throat membranes had swollen shut. The general was literally choking to death, and he recommended an immediate tracheotomy. Such a radical procedure had never been done in the United States at that time, and Brown and Craik rejected both the diagnosis and Dick's recommendation. The two older doctors continued to bleed him over the protests of both Martha and Dick, eventually drawing nearly 5 pints of blood from the dying man, almost half his body's blood supply. Unbeknownst to them, his larynx had swollen shut, and he was dying of asphyxia, aggravated by the dehydration and the loss of blood. A few minutes before 10 o'clock on Saturday night, as the helpless doctors looked on, Washington whispered his final words to Lear. "I am just going. Have me decently buried, and do not let my body be put into the vault in less than 3 days after I am dead. Do you understand?" Lear promised he would do as Washington asked. The general nodded slightly and said, "'Tis well." For a moment, his breathing became less labored, less ragged. A short time after, he felt his own pulse and then died. The father of the nation, its greatest war hero, its first president, quietly slipped away into history. His friend, his doctor, and his Masonic brother, Dr. Elisha Dick, turned away from the scene, knowing that he might very well have saved him had he been allowed to do what he knew was right. Dr. Craik would later admit with great sorrow that Dr. Dick had been correct, and that their friend might have survived if they had listened to him. Brother Dick walked across the general's bedroom to the clock that sat on the fireplace mantel. He reached into his pocket for the folding knife, opened the back of the clock, and sliced through a catgut string that operated its mechanism. The ticking stopped, and the hands froze at 10:20, where they remain to this day in George Washington's Masonic National Memorials Museum. News traveled slowly in those days. Congress was in a session in Philadelphia, and they would not know of Washington's death until the day of the funeral. Martha Washington followed the general's wishes for his burial. He would never be placed in the crypt, being prepared under the rotunda of the Capitol House being built across the river in the new city that would bear his name. Nor would he be enshrined in a new monument that would eventually be erected in geometric alignment with the Congress House and the President's House. He was first and foremost the master of Mount Vernon, a Virginia farmer, and there he would remain. Washington's body had been placed on a bed in Mount Vernon's front drawing room so that the cold would preserve him. No fires were lit. On December 17th, the lead-lined mahogany casket arrived. The next day, Wednesday, December 18th, the procession began to form outside Mount Vernon's mansion. Servants had cleared the snow between the house and the crypt, and mourners began to gather just before noon. The Virginia militia was delayed, so the gathering was given a last opportunity to view the body. At 3 p.m., the procession at last lined up and made their way to the place of burial. As they went, a schooner anchored out in the Potomac fired its cannon in salute. The Freemasons of Alexandria Lodge No. 22 assembled to perform their final duty to their fallen brother, sending him on to the Celestial Lodge above. His friend and brother, Dr. Elisha Dick, performed the Masonic funeral service, and the Reverend James Muir assisted with the prayers and Bible readings. The Reverend Thomas Davis read the Episcopal Prayers Book, funeral service, and praised Washington's character and virtues in the sermon that followed. Then, as it is still the practice today, the Mason stepped forward to conduct the final ceremony due a Master Mason. Worshipful Master Dick stood at the head of the casket and Reverend Muir at its foot, and they recited the service from memory. From time immemorial, Dr. Dick intoned, it has been the custom among the fraternity of free and accepted Masons at the request of a brother upon his deathbed to accompany his corpse to its place of interment and there to deposit his remains with the usual formalities. He spoke the same words used for all men of the fraternity, dustmen, cobblers, bankers, doctors, blacksmiths, and presidents, whose memory we revere and whose loss we now deplore. In death as in life, all Masons meet upon the level, act upon the plumb, and part upon the square, and the loss of one brother weakens the chain by which all Masons are united. Finally, Dr. Dick approached the body of Washington and deposited within the coffin his Masonic apron, an emblem of innocence and the badge of a Mason. It was followed by a sprig of evergreen representing the acacia plant, a Masonic symbol of immortality and rebirth. When they finished, the lead seal was laid in place, then the casket lid. The wooden box was closed and a black cloth was laid over the top. Washington's remains were carried into the vault, and its door was closed. The artillery and infantry assembled nearby simultaneously fired three volleys of traditional symbolic military ritual marking the end of the battle of life. The funeral party returned to the mansion after some light refreshments sadly went their separate ways. Several years later, the simple brick crypt was deemed too small for George and Martha's remains, and perhaps a little too simple. After 3 decades, a new crypt was built nearby. The gates were flanked with 2 matching Egyptian-style obelisks, foreshadowing the Washington Monument years before it would be constructed. Washington's will is fascinating to read. Apart from the many specific pieces of property he designated to family, friends, and servants, he made remarkable provisions for a man of his period. He freed his slaves upon the death of his wife Martha, the majority of them actually belonged to her, and saw to it that those who could not make their own way in the world would be provided for. He left money to start a free school for orphans. He established a university, but one seemingly small passage especially caught my eye as I looked over the carefully handwritten document. In it, he left his military swords to each of his nephews. Quote, accompanied with an injunction not to unsheathe them for the purpose of shedding blood except it be for self-defense or in defense of their country and its rights, and in the latter case, to keep them unsheathed and prefer falling with them in their hands to the relinquishment thereof. End quote. Honor remained his watchword, even as he contemplated his own death. Moreover, it was a lesson he insisted be passed on to the next generation. In short, Brother George Washington was in death as he was in life, a living example of Masonic principle of truth, honor, faith, hope, and charity. Excerpted from Solomon's Builders, Freemasons, Founding Fathers, and Secrets of Washington, D.C. The Freemasons of Alexandria Washington Lodge No. 22 will lay a memorial wreath at Washington's tomb each year on the 12th of December, just as it has done for over 200 years. Next is this week's famous Freemason, Gustavus R. Brown, one of the physicians called into the consultation during the last illness of George Washington. He was one of the organizers of St. Columbia Lodge No. 10, Port Tobacco, Maryland, and was the 5th Grand Master of Maryland, 1797. That's it for this week. Please remember to find us on Facebook and follow on Twitter at Whence Came You. If you can share the pages with your brothers and fellows, we need around 75 more likes on Facebook to get 500. Visit our website at wcypodcast.com for links to all of our social media pages and follow us on your favorite. Also, on our website are links to the apps and a whole lot more. Anyway, other than that, I hope you all have an amazing week. Stay on the level. Whence Came You? I'm Robert Johnson.